Thank you very much, Roger, for the introduction and for the invite. So in this talk, I'm going to talk about simulating Z2 quantum spin liquids using quantum simulators. So this work is done with broad collaborations with people from D-Wave and CoQuanta with Danny Dell, and also from people from Boston University, which is my advisor, Claudio, Shimon, and I, and also people from Cambridge University, who are Claudio Castelnuovo, Oli Hart, and Maria. So in this talk, first I'm going to talk briefly about quantum simulators and introduce very briefly the Z2 quantum spin liquid states, which specifically the toric code. And then I'm going to tell you the physically realizable quantum spin liquid model that uses only two body interactions and its actual realization in the D-Wave machines. And then at last, I'm going to propose an experiment to probe the fractional statistics of quantum spin liquid states in the quantum simulators. So then let's get started. So quantum simulators, there are two types of quantum computers. One is digital, which is circuit-based, and another one is analog, which you can think of as simulating Hamiltonians. And what makes quantum computer famous is perhaps, in theory, they should be able to simulate or solve some very hard problems. For example, factoring by using Schwarz algorithm. And if you can factor, and then you probably can break a lot of security protocols that are based on the RSA. And then you can also try to use quantum computers to do some optimizing problems, for example, traveling salesman's problem to help FedEx and UPS to deliver better. But perhaps what the physicists are most interested in is to use quantum computers to simulate many-body physical systems, for example, quantum spin liquids. So quantum spin liquids are actually very hard to observe in the natural materials in the lab. So instead, we can use quantum simulators to simulate such exotic states. So there have been experiments done with Rydberg atoms and superconducting qubits to simulate quantum spin liquids. But here, we want to provide a different approach, which is to simulate the exact Z2 quantum spin liquids as the ground states of a static programmable Hamiltonian. So to do that, before I dive into the detail of our work, I'm going to brush very quickly the toric code. Which is perhaps the most famous example of Z2 quantum spin liquid states. So the toric code lives on a square lattice. It has boundary conditions on both directions, and a Hamiltonian of toric code consists of star operators and plucket operators. And there are some very nice properties of toric code. Basically, is that the star operator and plucket operator, they all commute to each other. Hence, they commute with the Hamiltonian as well. And then you can write down the ground state basically is when the plughead and the star operators are being one. And then this is the ground state. And the ground state is basically you can picture it as the superposition of all kind of loop configurations in a torus. And the open string here shown on the graph indicates the excitations of toric code. And there are two types of excitations of toric code. So notice that the Hamiltonian of toric code has four-body interaction, but many of the quantum simulators, existing quantum simulators, only have two-body interactions. So the question is that how can we realize such state with four-body interactions in a quantum analog computers? So to do that, we need to use the combinatorial gauge symmetry, which helps us to realize the exact toric code ground state by using only two body interactions. So here's how it works. You have this normal star configuration, but other than the normal four spins sitting on the link, you have four extra degrees freedoms sitting on the vertex. So for a single star, now there are four gauge spins, sigma Z sitting on the link, and for another matter spin mu sitting on the vertex. And there are in total eight spins in each star governed by the star Hamiltonian. And see that the interactions between the gauge spins and matter spins follows this W matrix, which is basically gives you the combinatorial gauge symmetry. And if you look at this W matrix, you will see that it is nothing just the spin permutations and spin pi rotations for the Z2 cases. For example, this gauge spins following the W matrix interaction will couple to its adjacent matter spins anti-ferromagnetically and couple to the rest of the matter spins ferromagnetically. So this is how we're going to construct the combinatorial gauge symmetry that gives us the Z2 quantum spin liquid phase.
Can I ask a dumb question? Why are they called matter spins?
I think gauge and matters are the usual standard terms when you use the gauge theory, lattice gauge theory. But later you will see that we will effectively integrate out the matter spins that and then give us back to the toroidal Hamiltonian. Yeah. And notice that this star Hamiltonian is strictly two-body interaction, meaning that the gauge spin only coupled to the matter spins, does not couple to the rest of the gauge spins like the toroidal Hamiltonian. Okay. So now we can connect all of the stars together to form a square lattice. So the Hamiltonian is basically sum of all of the star operators, and the quantum fluctuation comes from the transverse field gamma tilde on the matter spins and the gamma on the gauge spins. Okay. And at the limit, when gamma tilde is much, much larger than J, we can effectively integrate out the matter spins in the vertex and derive this Hamiltonian, which the first term is exactly the star operator in the toroid code. And furthermore, to realize the toroid code, you just need to realize that in the perturbation limit gamma over lambda, the lowest surviving order is exactly the Plaquette term. And it has been confirmed by using quantum Monte Carlo that this combinatorial gauge symmetry Hamiltonian indeed has a Z2 quantum spin liquid phase, where the red curve is the theoretical prediction, and the dots here are the simulation data. So now we have this tool to use only two-body interactions, and we need to actually simulate them in the actual quantum simulators. So the simulator we choose to work with is D-Wave. And the exact machine we used is the D-Wave 2000 Q-chips, which it has in total 2,024 superconducting qubits made of Josephson conjunctions. And the connectivity between the qubits follows this chimera graph. It's basically a 16 by 16 unit cells. And in each unit cell, it has 8 spins, 4 vertical ones and 4 horizontal ones. And if you look at the unit cell in the middle here, it actually resembles the connections for our star operators for the combinatorial gauge symmetry case, which is perfect. And if you look at the D-Wave Hamiltonian, it consists of two parts. The first part is the transverse field part governed by the AS parameter. And the second part is the Ising part governed by the BS parameters. And A and B is basically governed by this annealing schedule. So in the beginning of the experiment, A is in its maximum value and B is zero, and your system is in the ground state of the sigma x basis. And when you adiabatically turn down the A and turn up the B, your system slowly anneals to the ground state of the Ising Hamiltonian that you program. Okay, so that's the idea behind the quantum annealing of D-Wave. So now what we need to do is we need to embed our Hamiltonian with combinatorial gauge symmetry into the chimera graph that I was showing you earlier. So it turns out to be a not very trivial business to actually connect adjacent stars together to form a square lattice. So for the sake of time, I'm going to skip the detail of how exactly we embed it. But the key idea here is that we have to copy the value of a gauge spins couple of times in order to realize the connections between adjacent stars. So in other words, what we did is that we used 4 physical qubits to effectively represent one gauge spins in its letters. And notice that even though we have such redundancy in the gauge spins, the combinatorial gauge symmetry is still respected. Okay. So now we have all of the embedding tools and we have the Hamiltonian and we are ready to do the experiments. So the experiments was done while I was locked down at home with my two cute pets. And the D-Wave machine we have, we used to, it sits in the Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico, United States. So I programmed the embedding along with instructions of how to do the annealing and also how to do some error correcting schemes to the D-Wave machine through their API. And the D-Wave machine conduct the experiments and do the measurements in a computational Z basis and gives me back plus minus one values for each qubit. And remember that we have to use four spins to represent one gauge spin. So the transverse field on the gauge spins now is in the fourth order. Okay. And this is what we expect happens inside of this black box of D-Wave, is that the experiment starts when the transverse field are large and follows this annealing path to cross the boundary between the paramagnetic and Z2 quantum spin liquid phase. And at the end, it lands in the classical endpoint, and that's where the measurement is being done. Okay, so enough about all of the preparations and how we.
I know it's the boring part, but I want to ask. So yeah. How do you access the LANO machine? So is it on the same cloud service as you would a commercial D-Wave machine, or does LANO have a special granting?
I mean, we didn't have to pay anything to access the LANO machine, but I had to apply for permission to use it because it's a national lab and I had some IDs and they give you some like two-factor things that's for the security to punch in every time you use the machine. Quite annoying, but unfortunately the D-Wave machine in LANO is being shut down. So they
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So some of our another work is we use the D-Wave for AWS. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah, of course. So now let's look at some data. So what you see here is a typical sample from the results done in the D-Wave simulations. So of course, with a lot of post-processing to make the graph presentable and pretty. And what you're looking at here is that there are some white areas in the middle. These indicate the broken qubits in the D-Wave machine we are using. And each bound or link here represents a spin. And the gold color represents spin up and the black color represents spin down. So as you can see from the sample that all of the spins in the sample try to line up to form a connected strings. And you do not see many connected loop configurations in the sample. It's because we have open boundary conditions. But each connected strings, they either terminate at the internal boundary or they terminate at the external boundary. For example, this one. So it starts from the internal boundary and traverses a long way and ended at the external boundary. So the parity of the whole toric code Z2 spin liquid is actually being preserved. So by just looking at these configurations, we are fairly confident to say that we realized the classical endpoint of the Z2 quantum spin liquid states in the D-Wave machines. But we actually can do more. We can, by tuning the diagonal element of the interaction W matrix, we can realize both spin ice and the ferromagnetic states. So eta is basically the amount of deviations of the diagonal elements of the W matrix. So when eta is exactly zero, we have the Z2 spin liquid state, which has been shown from the previous slides. But when eta is negative, we have the spin ice configuration. You can see all of the connective strings, they do not self-intersect, which is exactly the ice rule in the 2D square lattice. And then when eta is positive, we have the ferromagnetic phase, where panel C shows the all spin down situation, and panel D shows a domain wall separating the spin up and spin down places. But we can also map out the phase transitions or between those different phases by studying the eight vertex model. So the classical Z2 spin liquid states is also known as the eight vertex model, where basically each star respects the parity equals to one. Okay, so but furthermore, we split the eight vertex into two segments. One is six vertex and the other one is two vertex. And in a six vertex case, there is stars only have two up or two down legs. But in the two vertex cases, you have either all up or all down spins. And then by studying those eight vertex models, we can map out the phase diagram, where the orange arrow here separating the spin Z2 spin liquid phase from the broken Z2 phase, which is the ferromagnetic phase. And when eta is negative at temperature zero, we recover the spin ice case, which is also the six vertex case. Okay? And this is the phase diagram we obtained from the D-wave simulations, where on the right, the order parameter we choose here is the density of the two vertex, where on the right, we have the ferromagnetic phase because the two vertex density is approaching one. And on the left-hand side, we have the spin ice case where the two vertex density is approach zero. And exactly in the middle point when eta is equal to zero, the density of two vertex is a quarter, which is the eight vertex case, also the spin liquid phase. And we can furthermore study the probability density for each vertex of the eight vertex. So here, when eta is negative, the two vertex density is hugely suppressed. We have the six vertex, they are all equally probable. And exactly as when eta equal to zero, all eight vertices are equally probable. And when eta is positive, the six vertex probabilities are hugely suppressed. We left only with the two vertex cases. And the fluctuation of the two vertex here comes from boundary from the domain walls. Okay, so all of those data we acquired, and also the post-processing of the data we acquired from the D-Wave experiment, tells us that we indeed have the classical endpoint of Z2 quantum spin liquid states realized in the D-Wave machines. But what about quantum?
Sorry, this is cool. Couple of questions. So how many shots do you get out of the, like, how many times do you have to prepare the interactions on D-Wave and then run the annealing and get a measurement out and so on?
That's a great question. So for this graph, I already forgot how many grids there are. I cannot zoom in, but there are like maybe hundreds of grids, and each grid is I need to run separate experiment. So you can think of hundreds, close to be, I really don't remember how many grids there are, but each grid is one experiment and represents one different set of parameters. And for each grid, for each experiment, I obtain 1,000 samples to do the statistics.
Cool.
So in this diagram, actually has lots of samples being shown here.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yes. So I was saying that what we can claim is that we only realize the classical version of the quantum Z2 spin liquid state, but what about quantum? Can we actually observe any signatures of quantum spin liquids in the D-wave, for example? So to answer this question, we proposed this quasi 1D CGS ladder model. And the CGS here represents combinatorial gauge symmetry. So the Hamiltonian is still the same. It has this W interaction matrix. It has the transverse field on both matter spins and gauge spins. But now this model lives on the quasi 1D ladder, where the two adjacent stars share two gauge spins to form this 1D ladder configuration. And even in this quasi 1D ladder configuration structure, we still have the Z2 symmetry, which is generated by the operator GP, which this operator is a product of three different operators. BP is basically product of sigma x on the gauge spins out of the plug cap, and FPL and FPR acts on the matter spins of the adjacent stars. So FPL acts on the left-hand side star matter spins. And what it does is basically permutes spin 1, 2, 3, and 4, and flips spin 1, 2. Remember, the W matrix, all it does is just the permutation and spin rotations. And the FPR acts on the right-hand side matter spins of the stars. And what it does is to permute spin matter spin 1, 2, 3, and 4, and flips 3 and 4. Okay. So it can also be shown that the GP operator squares to 1, and each GP operator commutes with each other as well. So in order to better understand this model, we can also map this quasi 1D CGS ladder to a quasi 1D Z2 ladder shown on the right by studying their lower energy spectrums. So what I show here is the lower energy spectrum of two connected stars with fixed boundary conditions. So the boundary can either give you parity plus 1 or parity minus 1, depending on how do you fix it. Okay. And on the right, on the left, I show the energy spectrum of the CGS model. On the right, it's the energy spectrum of the Z2 model. And as you can see, and the dashed line here for each panel separates the case for the odd and the even conditions. Okay, and if you just compare the left and the right, you can see that for those two cases, the energy spectrum really resemble each other, even in the case when transverse field is turned on the lower two bottoms panels. And the inset here is just a zoom in situation of the level splitting when the transverse field is turned up in the negative parity situations. So now we establish the connection between the CGS ladder and the Z2 ladder. We can study how the excitations would propagate in each ladders. So the Z2 ladder, Z2 gauge ladder, is known to have two kind of excitations. One is the spin-out excitation, which is basically the violation of star operator, and its energy is roughly on the order of lambda. And the other excitation is called Vison. It's basically the energy violation of a plaquette operator, and its energy is roughly on the order gamma square over lambda. And we choose the gamma to be smaller than lambda. And we also consider the finite temperature regime where the temperature is in between a Vison gap and spin-out gap. And in this temperature regime, the Visons should be randomly stochastically located at random plaquette, because the formation energy of Vison is much smaller than the temperature. And furthermore, in a case when there is transverse field, the spin-out acquire dynamics in a time scale much larger than the Visons. So the Vison can also be considered as quasi-static. So in this finite temperature region, Visons can be considered stochastically located at random plaquettes and are quasi-static. This is going to be very useful because we can literally just treat Vison as random pi flux in a chain. Okay. So with that, we can propose the following experiments to study the spin-on dynamics, where you can imagine you initialize a spin-on in one star, and in the case when there is no vison at all, which is indicated by zero, the spin-on can freely propagate to the stars on the right or left. But however, when there is vison in the plug head on the right of the spin-on, the top and the bottom passes of the spin-on to propagate to the right acquire two opposite phases. That gives rise to a destructive interference pattern, and spin-on are not able to move to the right anymore in that situation. And furthermore, we can freeze the bottom legs of this 1D ladder by, for example, painting a very strong longitudinal field. And in that case, even with the vison, the spin-on can travel to the stars on the right. So what happens here is that the presence of vison basically cuts this 1D chain into segments and localizes the spin-on dynamics. And with this bottom two experiments interplay, we can basically probe the mutual statistics of spin-ons and visons in a Z2 quantum spin liquid states. Okay. So we all know that all of the NISQ devices have some kind of disorders, some kind of noises. So we also study the spin-on dynamics propagation subject to different kind of noises, specifically the diagonal disorders and off-diagonal disorders. And the noises are basically Gaussian distributed with zero mean and with standard deviation sigma. So here what we are looking at is the mean squared displacement of spin-on propagation versus time. So the blue curve represents the case where there is no spin-on and vison statistics interplay. And you can see that the spin-on propagates ballistically to the end of the chain. And however, when there is visons, the spin-on does not propagate more than one letter site apart. So the mean squared displacement saturates around one letter site. And this distinction between those two cases are very persistent, even with very strong diagonal disorders. However, this distinction disappears or becomes weaker and weaker when we turn up the off-diagonal disorder. And as you can see, when the off-diagonal disorder is on the order of the hopping amplitude, those two cases basically merge. Okay. But also we study how does the vison dynamics affect our spin-on dynamics, in the sense that previously we assumed vison dynamics are static. But in the quantum simulators, there will be some noises, which is coming from the longitudinal field, and those longitudinal fields will invoke the vison dynamics. So here, delta t characterized how fast the visons are moving. When delta t is really large, the visons are basically static. But when you decrease delta t, the visons are moving faster and faster. So as we can see that when we have static vison, the spin-on saturates at the one letter site. But when we turn up the vison dynamics, the spin-on start to propagate to the later sites. And at later time, it basically propagates all the way to the end of the edge, end of the chain.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How do you carry out the simulation? So is this the bosonic model you presented? Then you do real-time dynamics.
Yes, so it's a great question. So the simulation part is done by Maria, which is a student by of Claudio Castanova. She did a fantastic job. What we did here is that we basically map, if you consider a system only have one spin-ons with visons on the background, you can actually just promote it to a tight binding model. But with when the hopping amplitude is governed by if you have a vison or not.
So right. So and if this vison is static, then this is just one particle, right? Like and so it's easy to simulate, I assume, right?
Yes. Exactly. It's if you consider vison static, it's just the information is fed into the hopping amplitude, and it's just a one single particle simulation, which is quite easy.
And also, One more question. But when you have dynamic visons, what do you do? Do you average over configurations?
Yes. So when you have dynamic visons, what you have to do is you have to update the hopping amplitude with time. So over here, you choose a hopping amplitude configuration. So you have a hopping amplitude configuration information you have to keep track. So for all of the experiment here, it's more like the hopping amplitude are fixed. But with here, you have to update stochastically update, and the updation frequency is characterized by this delta t, and that's how you see the spin on start to traveling.
I see. So one more question. So this is very interesting. So when you do this update, you assume that the visons are completely decoupled and random, right? Like, is that?
Vison, we assume they are completely decoupled and random. It's because the temperature is larger than the vison gap. So in that case, we can think of, fantastic.
Great. Thank you so much.
Now we studied how vison dynamics can affect the spin-on dynamics. So we more have a comprehensive picture of the spin-on dynamics in our proposal. And we actually tried to implement such experiment in a D-Wave machine as well. We run into two challenges of doing that. First is that the D-Wave operating temperature, which is around 30 millikelvin or 50 millikelvin, is still too high for our experiment. And the second challenge is that the characteristic time scale for our experiment is in the nanosecond, which is much smaller than the microsecond time scale in D-Wave that you can measure. We could not observe any signatures of the localization of spin-ons in the D-Wave. But we thought about maybe we can go use the Rydberg system to simulate such experiments. But then we quickly realized, we actually contact them, we talk about it, but we quickly realized that it's very hard to realize the connectivity of a single star in the Rydberg system, especially with both plus minus one IC interactions in the Rydberg system. So at the end, I would like to summarize our work. So we designed Hamiltonians with the combinatorial gauge symmetry using only local pairwise interactions, where the exact quantum z to spin liquid states are the ground state of the static Hamiltonians. And then we showed the how to realize such quantum spin liquid states in the D-Wave machines, and we actually realized the classical endpoint version of that. And we also proposed a smoking gun experiment to detect the mutual statistics of quasi-particle excitations in the Z2 quantum spin liquid states in the quantum simulators. And then at the end, I would like to go a little bit tangential of this talk is to talk about what I am actually working on right now. Is that I'm trying to using the D-Wave machines to actually simulate this very interesting phase called fractal symmetries to see their excitations forming exactly the fractal, specifically Sierpinski gasket formations, which will be very exciting to see in the quantum simulators. And And secondly, I have been thinking a lot, especially working on a couple of different quantum simulators, that they all provide the basis measurement. And we had such a hard time to convince people and to convince us that the data we acquired from D-Wave are actually quantum. So I was thinking about, is there any information we can extract from just the solely the basis measurement of quantum simulations? I think this would be a very interesting problem to work on. And also the last one is very tangential to this work. It's basically, I've done some work in my PhD to study the transition of Clifford circuits to the universal circuits by adding T gates. So now we are trying to see if machine learning can detect such transition. And if it can, we can actually use machine learning to learn different kind of circuits. For example, T design, we can learn out different T designs. That's a very early work we just started, but I'm very excited about it. So with that all, I would like to thank you for your attention and your questions.
Thank you, Xiyu.
Thank you.
Amazing. Questions, anyone? Before I start.
Can I go first?
No.
So the wave machine has this reverse annealing feature, where you can start the annealer in a configuration and then ramp up the transverse field, wait for a little bit, and then measure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly how inspired us to do such experiment. Because if you need this experiment to be done in D-Wave, you have to do reverse annealing. Basically, initial state that has spin out initialized. Sorry. And then you turn up the transverse field to see how the spin-out propagates when transverse on, and then you quickly turn down the transverse field to measure. That's how we were doing in a D-Wave, but I kind of just brushed it under the carpet. So
I see. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, of course.
Ben, you waiting to ask a question?
Anyone else? Yes, Scott. Ask a question. Yeah, I just am curious about your kind of thing at the end that you're working on and extracting information from the Z basis. Because, I mean, I think that's something that we think about a little bit too. So, are you gonna? I mean, I guess we work with stochastic Hamiltonians where the Z basis is kind of enough information. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In that sense, so are you gonna look at, I guess, non-stochastic Hamiltonians and? Yeah, I just am curious about how you're planning to mm-hmm. do this.
Yes, that's a very, very great question. So the short answer is I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out what we can do from, you know, you get a huge amount of data from the quantum simulations. What can you do about it? Can you extract anything from the just the solely Z basis measurement? Because tomography is very pricey. You know, I talked to, maybe many of you know her, I talked to Umna Kim about this before, that she thinks maybe using machine learning can do something, but there are other people who actually were able to extract information about like central charge from the conformal field theory, basically using basis measurements. But in that case, they also, I think there's some information we can extract from just the Z basis measurements, but maybe not universal information about all kind of information you want to know from the tomography. But I'm still trying to figure out what we can, you know, what we can do. Yeah, that's a great question.
I was just curious how maybe it works in practice. You said that's usually the kind of the option you have when you're working with these quantum simulators. So they don't allow you to get measurements in other bases. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Yes. So I think the commercially available ones for example, QRA and D-Wave, specifically D-Wave, you cannot have other basis measurements. But I know that when they were doing the experiment for this quantum spin liquid states on the Rydberg system, they were able to do some trick to basically you use some pulses into the transfer into X spaces, and then do the measurements on the X spaces, and that's very strong, you know, indication telling make them to say that they had the quantum spin liquids, but that's not commercially available, and I don't know if they are going to make it commercially available. So and the Z basis, it seems to be it's perhaps the most convenient basis to measure for a lot of simulators. So like being able to use the limited amount of resources to extract the most amount of information, I think it would be very meaningful. I don't know how to do it, but I think you know, people are always trying, and I think it's a very meaningful question.
Anna?
Can you hear me? Just because I know some of my laptop has issues. Okay, cool. Yeah, thanks for the talk. Just curious about this combinatorial gauge symmetry. Where did that concept really come from? I've just never been familiar with that language.
Yes, that's a great question. It actually was invented by my advisor, and he's back then senior student when I was just joined the group, and his collaborator Dimitri Green. So the motivation of doing this combinatorial gauge symmetry is literally how can you realize a four-body interaction, which also respects the local Z2 symmetries, but using only two a body interaction, and you still have the Z2 local symmetries. So that's how they came up this model, and they named it combinatorial. It's because the W matrix has plus minus one. It's monomial. Yeah.
Cool. And then in that QC simulation, could you just repeat what the order parameter or the observable was that you used? Yeah,
okay. This is a great question. I actually do not know exactly. Maybe it's some it's definitely some order parameter observation, but I did not do this work. It's actually a student from Andrew Senevic's group did it, and he was able to extract the order parameter that's separating the Z2 deconfined phase and confined phase from the quantum Monte Carlo simulations. And show us the but that's a great question. I should go back to check on his paper exactly what the order parameter he used.
No, cool. No, I see how it sounds like perfect. Okay.
Yeah.
Ben?
I just had a question about the last point you had in your Outlook slide, and sort of like current ideas you're working on. And it's the machine learning of Clifford circuits versus universal. I'm just curious, like, sort of what you have in mind there, like what signatures you want to learn, like, if you just elaborate a bit.
Yeah, and that's a great question, because it's kind of funny the way we acquired this idea is actually from replying to referees. So that paper we had on Clifford circuits transition to universal circuits by adding TGIS was actually by studying the transition of entanglement spectrum level statistics. But we had such a trouble to convincing referees that this is true, this is cool. So we have to come up all kinds of different ideas to convince them. So one of the ideas that we came up is that we literally just look at the wave function coming out of the circuits at the end. And we literally just reshape the wave function into a square, square image. And then by just literally looking at them, and we realized that the Clifford circuits, the wave function actually has a very well-defined pattern. But however, you can expect the wave function coming from the universal circuit has a very chaotic, there's no order at all. So that's where we thought about maybe machine learning can detect something about the underlying circuit structure. Specifically here, we have the non-universal and universal circuit distinction. But there are also other, like we know Clifford is close to be three design circuits, but perhaps, the machine learning can tell us what design you exactly have for the circuits, And on furthermore, we can think about, you know, when does the, you know, there are a lot of interesting questions we can ask when does it reach pseudo random, which is a great question, a very important question to ask for the cryptography folks. I'm very excited about it. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Just following up on Skylar's question for their second last point here, which I really like. Isn't what you implemented on D-Wave a stochastic Hamiltonian?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. So, and how many measurements do you have for any given set of parameters? Like 1,000?
Yeah, 1,000, yeah.
And how many qubits is it?
It's 2048 minus, wow. Allow me to do some calculation. I remember it was 120 qubit stars times 8. Roughly 900 qubits.
Okay.
Roughly,
But in principle, if you sat on one point in the phase diagram and collected enough data in the Z basis, it's enough to reconstruct the reconstruct the wave function if there's no noise. I don't know about the noise issue there, right? So.
Yes.
Because you're informationally complete in the Z basis for a ground state.
Yeah, that is exactly true. But what we were hoping is that during the annealing process, we actually landed in the quantum Z2 spin liquid phase. And then, although the measurement is done when the and the classical endpoint. So this question that I raised here is not exactly related to the experiments we are trying to do, because here what we are trying to do is probe quantum. But this question is much broader in the sense that, can you probe entanglement entropy? Can you probe like entanglement entropy, like not necessarily an analog-based quantum simulators, but gate-based? Or can you probe other like, for example, quantum simulator completely exotic phases? Can you learn something like a phase that we really do not know how to characterize? Use normal order parameters. Can you use the Z basis measurements to tell us something?
Cool.
Things align the line,
I think the answer is yes.
You think so?
Yeah, for sure. For stochastic Hamiltonians, yeah.
Oh yes, stochastic Hamiltonians. Yes. Yeah, but what about for any kind of Hamiltonians?
Then you need tomography if it's non-stochastic, right?
Yeah, but
then you need additional measurements in different bases.
Yeah, but there is one work by this lady from IBM that she was able to show that she can use just the Z basis measurement to extract a central charge for XXZ Hamiltonian, which is not a stochastic Hamiltonian anymore. And I think that is kind of very cool in my opinion. And there's no tomography done, it's just a Z basis measurement.
I think it's conceivable that you could learn something.
Maybe you won't learn everything.
Like you can't learn the quantum state. But I agree that you could probably learn something to be determined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the question is what?
Yeah, you know? For sure.
Yeah.
Super fun.
Awesome discussion, but we should let you go to the conference.
Yes, thank
you. Any urgent last minute questions here? If not, let's thank Shiyu again.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation and for your attention.